Now, detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The truth is out there.
The military-industrial complex.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult of propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is a view from the bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
We almost missed an annual tradition here of View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert, and joining me today is a guest who has been a regular in the past, and it seems that we fell into a pattern some years ago of discussing issues of the supernatural around Halloween, which is the time of year when we are awash in it in our culture. This year, the time almost got away from us, but better a few days late than never. We're going to talk today about the spirits and the demonic realm, their origins, and we will see where we go from there, because we've been talking before beginning the broadcast today, and I think we've got a lot of things that we could spend some time on. He does have a new book out. He is the author of the groundbreaking book Interview with the Giant, Ethno-Historical Notes on the Nephilim, but his new book, which is derived from his doctoral dissertation, Peneus, Religion in the Ancient City of Pan. You can see I'm holding the book up here, and I mean to read it off the cover. We welcome back to the program for the first time in far too long our friendly neighborhood PhD, Dr. Judd Burton. Judd, welcome back.
Good to be back, Derek. Thank you.
Should mention right up front, your website is burtonbeyond.com for people who want to dig more into your work and your writings. But Judd, long day. We were hauling boxes of stuff out of the garage to a back bedroom today, so I'm still not back to normal here. Founder director of the Institute of Biblical Anthropology is Judd. So, and that website is tioba.org. All right, now that we've got all that stuff out of the way, the book Peneus, the Ancient City of Pan. We're talking about a location that most of our listeners, I think, are familiar with, but for those not familiar with the title of this particular location, why did you choose to make Peneus the subject of this book?
Well, of course, Peneus is, I suspect that most people would be familiar with it through its reference in the New Testament in Matthew chapter 16 and Mark chapter 8, as Caesarea Philippi. Peneus is the older Greek designation of the site. But Peneus is it's been part of my journey for quite a while. I was introduced to the site not just in terms of my Christian upbringing, but a mentor of mine, my Greek professor, in fact, had told me about it and told me to sign up for volunteering on one of the excavations that the university supported. And I ended up doing that and became fascinated with the history of the region, and ended up writing my dissertation on the site of Peneus. But Peneus, the modern name is Banias, the Arabic rendering. And so you'll hear me use a number of names, Peneus, Banias, Caesarea Philippi. It's gone through a laundry list of names over the course of the history, but I'm talking about the same region, the same city. But its importance in the story of the Watchers, the giants, you know, all of the taxonomy, if you will, of the tribes and clans of giants, is really quite crucial because of its connection with the most proximate mountain, which would be Mount Hermon.
Right. So Peneus is right essentially at the foot of Mount Hermon.
That's right. It's on a southwestern spur of Mount Hermon, at the base of the mountain itself. With the, it's a very beautiful, very lush location. It's not in stark contrast geographically with the the southern portion of Israel, which is arid, desert region. This is a very temperate, lush area with oak groves, and the headwaters of the Jordan can be found in this region. And there is a large cave at the base of the mountain, which the ancients saw as auspicious, and then immediately connected it with, again, a line of gods. The first of these, being the Semitic peoples that lived in the region, probably the oldest deity associated with the cave is one of their Bels. But when the Greeks came through the region, they attributed the identity of this deity to be Pan. And that's how the region got its name, the Pantheon of Timaeus, as it's first mentioned in Josephus.
So when
Polybius actually is the first Greek historian to reference.
So you say that the earliest deities, before the Greeks arrived, and your book basically begins with the Greek period and continues on until the 17th century. Why did you begin with the Greek period instead of going further back into, all the way back to through the age of the Amorites, for example?
Well, I actually do begin actually in prehistory.
Hmm.
That's not to say that the bulk of the study is not within the Greco-Roman period. But I actually do go all the way back into prehistory. The second chapter is the first in the study called Pan of Many Faces. And this is based on a paper that I wrote for conference probably almost 10 years ago, about the time I was writing my dissertation. And I undertook a kind of comparative mythological study. And this one does go all the way back to prehistory and deals with the sort of Chalcolithic and the Bronze Age cultures that would have been living in the region, and deals with the at least the types of deities that they would have been worshiping. Of course, students of the Bible will be familiar with that very iconic word, Baal.
Mm-hmm.
And there were the truth is that there were a number of Baals, some of them in the Old Testament are mentioned by name that are likely attached to this region, one being the Baal Hermon,
mm-hmm.
and the other one being the Baal Gad, which scholars have debated over the years as to which one is associated with this particular site, the cave site.
Now,
I actually do go back to prehistory to begin this.
Okay, okay. Now, and you know what? I think I got that impression from reading your paper, your dissertation, which I found online. Where did the tribe of Gad, the Israelite tribe of Gad, when they settled in the Holy Land, they were one of the tribes that settled east of the Jordan, along with Reuben and half Manasseh. Where did Gad settle? Were they in that region, or were they further south?
It seems to me that the tribe of Gad was a little bit further south.
Right. They were close to Moab because the Moabite stone,
right.
King Misha talked about taking on the men of Gad. Right. Okay. It was Manasseh.
Right.
Manasseh was southeast of Hermon, and the tribe of Dan, when they relocated up and took the city of Laish, settled where Peneus is now. So.
That's right. The very
okay.
Scorned tribe of Dan.
Yeah. So the and Gad is a word that name is actually translates fortune. I found that Gad is the name of one of the Canaanite deities. Isaiah was very critical of the Israelites for setting out a place for Gad, and I can't remember the other One translated means destiny. So Gad, which means fortune, and then another Canaanite deity, destiny, were apparently being venerated or worshipped in the time of Isaiah, the time of Hezekiah.
That's right. And it's also, it's likely also the source of the word God. And has entered popular parlance. Probably heard the expression "ye gads."
Yeah,
well, that's directly related to this the sort of linguistic parade over the millennia.
Huh.
That all goes back to this word "gad."
Did not know that. And of course, the name of one of the tribes of Israel, which makes you wonder what was in the mind of his mother when she decided to name him that. Baal Hermon, interesting connection. If we remember before the end of the program, nudge me about Baal Hermon and the link possible to possible link to Jack the Ripper.
Yes, indeed.
Sharon stumbled onto that one, and it's actually historic.
Well, and you may have to nudge me too, because one of my one of the titles of the chapters in here, which I took in part from Interview with the Giant, because I dealt with this topic, the God of the Razor, which is an allusion to Azazel, which I've not only myself but other scholars and researchers deposited as the same personality as Pan.
Right. And the source of the word panic and pandemonium. Well, let's talk.
I don't know how. Go ahead.
I was going to say. Well, let's talk about that, about Pan and the goat demons. Again, this is something that pops up in the book of Isaiah, where the Israelites are condemned for also Deuteronomy for worshiping the Seirim while they were in the
That's
desert.
Right.
The hairy ones, the goat demons, is how it's translated in the Old Testament. And there's that strange command to the to the nation that for redemption of sin for the people of Israel, they were to send a goat out into the desert, you know, Azazel, you know, let the sins of the people be on Azazel. And what is the link between Azazel, Pan, and Peneus at the foot of Mount Hermon?
Well, it's a matter of geography and tradition, I think. As a side note to that, can you imagine a sermon being preached from the pulpit with that translation of the passage from Isaiah being used? Because it's usually the hairy ones and the he-goats.
Right.
You know, they don't talk about the goat demons and mm-hmm. the satyrs or what have you. But that's what these serim are. That for all intents and purposes, to give people a visual, they're reminiscent of the popular image that we have from art
mm-hmm.
of Pan, with the half goat, half man sort of configuration.
Right, and he's happy and carefree and playing on his lute and this, that, and the other. They don't show you that little X-rated statue from ancient Greece of Pan and a goat.
Yes, there are images, not only in statuary, but also in art that are really pornographic.
Explicit, yes, yes.
Explicitly pornographic, yeah. There are no bones about it. But that's usually, again, the filter through which we get all of this mythology, you know, unfortunately, these days.
Mm-hmm.
The whole story of Pan is not even told. You know, looking from these happy, sprightly little renderings of Pan we've had in art over the years, you would never guess that he was associated with warfare.
Right.
But after, you know, at the Battle of Marathon, you know, the victory was ascribed to his intervention, and that his war cry was terrifying, according to legend, and that's where we get the word panic from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is. You know, there are tales of him presenting Zeus, you know, with his goat skin, goat hided shield, the Ix, which is again a Greek cognate that means goat. So there are all these other elements of the story that aren't popular. You know, they're not typically told about the god Pan. You know, he's not just this sprightly fellow who plays his panpipes and, you know, saunters through the woods with a lot of dryads and nymphs following him. He's this very lusty, warmongering creature.
Mm-hmm.
That's, if we go back to the accounts that we have from the non-canon material, like Enoch especially, which listeners will no doubt be familiar with, there are passages that give us some insight into the character and the identity of Azazel. And he's very much associated with war, if we're to believe the account from Enoch, because what does he do? He teaches metalsmithing and warcraft to this early generation of humanity in exchange for this genetic access to the human genome.
Mm-hmm. So what is this?
He also teaches this. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask about the translation, you know, God of the Razor. And that reference, but I don't want to sidetrack where you're going.
That's literary license. That's just artistic license. It's something that it seemed appropriate. Because he was a teacher of making swords and spears.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But he also taught, and this is another element of Pan, and for that matter, Azazel. He also, you know, in the accounts in Enoch, he's ascribed all sin. You know, that's a direct quote. What he did, what he revealed to humanity, these secrets of heaven, were not to be, at least at that time. And you know, from what the other watchers were teaching, these fallen angels, we can piece together that what they were teaching was a combination of practical sciences and the occult or witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And Pan is associated with mysticism and dreaming and prophecy. These are other characteristics of the god Pan that are often overlooked in a general survey of the deity. Again, getting fed these popular images of this sprightly character who's just happy-go-lucky all the time, but when in fact you had this very violent, again, lusty sorcerer for all intents and purposes. And those roots, in my research, seem to point all the way back to Azazel. Given the location of Mount Hermon and the fact that Azazel was so associated with the corruption of humanity at that point in that region, and the fact that you later, in later centuries, have this shrine site that's being recycled, it's being used over and over again by different cultures, and you finally have the Greeks come in and give a name to this deity. They see it as their own Pan, the god of shepherds and goatherds. But there were other regional deities that were goat-like as well that I've talked about in my research over the years, and I include also in the book Pananus. There were Semitic deities like Odds and Uds who were goat deities. And the Adzaga was this Mesopotamian goat deity that was worshipped by everybody from Babylon to the Amorite kingdom. And of course, the Amorite kingdom is just right there. It's very approximate, just to the east
mm-hmm.
Of what would today be the Golan Heights.
Yeah, Og, king of Bashan. Yeah.
That's right.
But But you're interesting. So, interestingly, though, the Amorites were known as pastoral people going all the way back to the middle of the third millennium BC. You know, 2600 BC. They were known as the as pastoral types, herding their flocks around. They were thought to be mountaineers, which would fit with the herding of goats and sheep. They were warlike to the point where they really intimidated their neighbors. And by the time of Abraham, they basically had taken over all of the ancient Near East, everything that today is Iraq, Syria. It's kind of like the early version of the Islamic State, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, even northern Egypt by the time of Joseph was under the control of Amorites. When we call them Babylonians, all we're doing is designating Eastern Amorites, and Canaanites were just referring to Western Amorites. They were all Amorites.
Yes, that's very true. The another thing that's often overlooked is that the Amorites were Mesopotamians.
Mm-hmm.
They had adopted that modality.
Right.
Well, and another interesting thing, you're talking about the roots of pastoralism in this region. One of the theories that I put forward in my dissertation work is that there is a possibility that the Greeks derived this idea of Pan, or took or borrowed this god even from the ancient Near East. And there are a number of ways that this could have been. Of course, the idea of this goat deity, this goat demon, is far older than even the Minoans and the Mycenaean civilization.
It certainly
predates the Archaic and the classical civilizations, the Hellenic civilizations of Greece as well. And it's well known, not even debated among scholars, that the Greeks took a number of their deities from the East. They were enamored, in fact, with the Levant and the ancient Near East and Egypt.
Absolutely.
And there were two distinct periods of what scholars call Orientalizing, in which the art of the period, particularly in the first one is during the late Bronze Age, early Iron Age, when the Mycenaeans were trading with that region. The second one, and the more prolific one, is during the Archaic phase, somewhere around probably the between the 9th, 8th, 7th centuries BC. That's when this is all developing.
Okay, now late Bronze Age, you're talking about the time of the Judges there or thereabouts?
First late period? Bronze Age would be pretty close to the time of the Judges, late Bronze, early Iron Age. Right?
Okay, which is interesting because they just had that news item from a couple of weeks ago translating a text that was found in what is now Turkey. I think in the 1880s, it was copied by a French archaeologist, and then the original was lost because the people in the town used the stones to build a mosque. Thank you very much. They translated it. It was a script in a language called Luwian, which is was one of the Hittite languages or languages spoken by the Hittite people in north end of the Black Sea, north of the Mediterranean, so northwest of what is now the border between Syria and Turkey. But anyway, it appears to describe a successful military campaign led by a prince of Troy, and that group among the sea peoples wound up settling at Ashkelon, one of the Philistine cities. So.
Oh, yes, yeah, these records were, they also mention I know the find that you're talking about, they also mention, without getting too far off topic, but they also mention the side of Troy, the city-state of Troy, they mention
right.
King Priam, they mention the region Ilios in which the city was in, they mention the word Achaean, which was the name of the Mycenaean Confederacy.
Right.
I believe Agamemnon's name is also mentioned, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, but these are all Hittite records. They're outside
right.
sources confirming this historical event, the Trojan, that we call the Trojan War, that Homer
right.
mythologized in his account.
And yeah. what's fascinating, and again, getting back to the subject of orientalizing the Greek pantheon, contrary to what many scholars have believed, which is that the Greek pantheon comes from Indo-European sources and had nothing to do with those, you know, Jews and Mesopotamians and those, you know,
right.
Semitic peoples. That, no, I'm sorry. Zeus, the storm god, is just Baal with a different name. Baal Hadad
that's,
with
yeah,
a different
that's
name.
The god. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can make a really good case based on texts that have been found on the island of Cyprus that Apollo, who was one of the gods who was all in favor, who was supporting Troy in this war, in the Trojan War, was actually the Semitic god Reshef, who was just the Babylonian god Nergal. So, you know, you've got the same warrior god with the as an archer who spreads plague and pestilence, also serving as the gatekeeper to the underworld, which is significant.
That's what I'm saying. The debate's not even there. The precedent
right.
for this happening is very clear. And when you take a look at this later archaic period orientalizing, when you got trade between the Greeks and the Phoenicians, there are two kinds of artifacts, Corinthian and Athenian redware, which were kind of, you know, they were the trending item
mm-hmm.
at the time. Everybody needed to have them. They were kind of multi-purpose vessels. But the Corinthian redware was slightly, you know, it was slightly more popular, and it had these images from Near Eastern mythology of sphinxes and bull men and things like cherubim, and, you know, the kinds of things that you would find from Near Eastern mythology.
Yeah, yeah.
So the precedent is there. It's not when these sorts of things are happening. You've got this trade taking place between these two regions. It's not just economy in terms of commerce, it's economy in terms of ideas and traditions and religious rights and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, because of a number of things, including this which I deal with in my dissertation in more detail, this shield of Zeus's, by the way, the Ix.
Mm-hmm.
You've got phonetic similarity there with odds and uds and, you know, these cognates that existed in the region that were used to describe these sorts of gods. And so I think it's more than a possibility that Pan is yet, you know, or in this case, you know, Pan Azazel is yet another one of these pastoral, or not just pastoral deities, but deities in general that were borrowed and grafted into the Greek pantheon, as it were.
Well, let me run this past you, because this is research I turned up for my book, The Great Inception.
Run it past me.
The one of the aspects of Pan, called Aegipan, if I'm pronouncing that correctly,
mm-hmm.
if I remember correctly,
Aegipan.
Uh-huh. Aegipan helped Zeus in his struggle against the chaos monster Typhon.
That's right.
And that was when he jumped into the Nile and was transformed into a half-goat, half-fish.
That's right.
Now,
the Capricorn symbol.
Exactly, which traces all the way back to ancient Sumer, because one of the symbols of the ancient god Enki, whose name is a compound word meaning Lord, En, and Ki, Earth, Lord of the Earth, mm-hmm. whose temple at the city of Eridu, and I argue in the book that was actually the Tower of Babel, was called the Eabzu, House of the Abzu. And Abzu is the word from which we get the English word abyss. So the symbol of the Lord of the Abyss was the goatfish, the carp goat, this half goat, half fish that turns up later as an assistant to Zeus, the storm god, whose holy mountain just happens to be Mount Typhon, Jebel al-Akra, where he did battle with Typhon, in fact. And that was, of course, the holy mountain of Baal Hadad, or Baal Typhon.
Of course, being Plasmin, of course, being the analogous to the Leviathan in the story.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So you've got this borrowing taking place from Sumer of this symbol of the Lord of the Abyss, who helps out the storm god, the king of the gods, for the Greeks and for the Amorites, the Western Amorites anyway, the Marduk, the Eastern Babylonians was the king of their king of their gods, but for the Hittites and the Hurrians and the Urartrians of the kingdom of Urartu or Ararat,
yeah.
the king of their pantheon was the storm god. Just same deity, different, even Indra in the Indus River Valley, the Indus Valley civilization was a storm god.
Right,
the Harappan.
Right,
the Harappan. And, you know, so it's the same deity, different name. And you've got these parallels that all go back, not just to Babylon and Mesopotamia, but back to ancient Sumer, to this ancient deity Enki, whose temple, according to archaeologists, dates all the way back to 5000 BC, when the civilization emerged, apparently fully formed out of the Persian Gulf.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that what we're looking at here is just as in the case of, you know, take something like the flood epic from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Without too much variation, you certainly find versions of that throughout that region, the Near East and the Mediterranean basin. You know, you've got Utnapishtim in Mesopotamia, and you've got Deucalion in the story of the Greek flood epic, and you spin the globe,
mm-hmm.
and you find all of these stories. And what you're looking at are different versions, different interpretations of the same event. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but, you know, those of us who are involved in this sort of research recognize, I think, pretty readily the mythological chain of events here and the personalities and identities that we're dealing with here. They're different names, but they're the same god.
Right, right. So Azazel, and by the way, you mentioned something in passing that I want to bring up because people would be familiar with this name if they've read the Book of Job, and that is, how would you pronounce it? Uz, Uz, Uts?
Uz, that's right.
Uz, and you connect that to Azazel as well, and from what little I know about the Book of Job, that is probably the region, you know, east of the Jordan, the Trans-Jordan was probably the region where Job lived.
Right, right, that's my understanding as well. Well, yeah. You know, for ancient Semitic languages, you know, in a number of languages really throughout the region, the same can be said of a number of languages, but the vowels came much later.
Mm-hmm.
Consonant constructs were there, and you filled in. You've probably seen, a lot of people listening have probably seen the exercises with John 3:16, where you take all the vowels out. Well, you can still read it
mm-hmm.
and understand it. Well, that's how these ancient Semitic languages operated. It's the vowels that came later. And
right.
So in the case of not only Uzi and Az, you're looking at the same phoneme here. The same little piece of a word. So the identity, in my mind, and I'm sure this would be echoed by other scholars, the identity is the same thing.
Hmm. And what's fascinating about placing Uz or Az or Azazel in the region of Mount Hermon again in Peneus is that one of the Egyptian execration texts, which was sort of their version of the voodoo doll, they would write down the names of their enemies on ceramic and then smash the ceramic after cursing it to try to curse their enemies. They named a ruler of the region in the region of Bashan, Mount Hermon, as Ayab, which is an older form of the name Job. Probably not the biblical patriarch, but it's known that there were people with that name in that region in roughly that period of history.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it wouldn't be uncommon for that name to be passed down, you know, from generation to generation.
Right. Well, David's general, Joab. Yeah. So the religious significance of Mount Hermon with Peneus and of course the Grotto of Pan there. What sort of spiritual influence did that have on the region? I mean, how did that manifest when we get down to biblical times? How did that?
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, how did that manifest in either its influence on the Israelites or the neighbors of the Israelites, and how they had to respond to what their neighbors' religious practices and beliefs?
Well, from what we can tell, of course, those levels archaeologically are all but obscure to us for the shrine site itself. But just as in the Hellenic period when the Seleucids were the Ptolemies first, and then the Seleucids had control of the region. The shrine at that time was pretty nondescript. The same could definitely, I think, be said for the centuries before that. That you're looking at just a cave as a shrine. There may have been votives, you know, that were brought to it, but fairly nondescript. They recognized the auspiciousness of this as sort of a natural temple, so they didn't have to do a lot to it. But as far as the region itself, of course, the mountain, Mount Hermon, of course, was a boundary marker for the northern extent of Israel, and so it had geographical significance. But in terms of spiritual significance, undoubtedly, because actual archaeological evidence has been found, minuscule though it may be, on the mountain itself, that there were these ancient Semitic pagan rites that were being conducted. So it from early on, it has a very, I wouldn't say crucial spiritual significance, but it's definitely part of the overarching general sort of ancient Semitic pagan world. So it was important certainly to the people who lived in the vicinity of the region. What's interesting to me is that when you get to the Hellenic period, you start to see more contention over the region. In fact, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids actually fought a battle at Peneus. It was called Polybius called it the Battle of the Peneon, and this saw the land transition from ownership from the Ptolemies to the Seleucids. And after that, there was more activity at the shrine, and you start to see more evidence of votive offerings left in the cave. Of course, a lot of it's just debitage, just crumbled pottery at that time in the archaeological record, but we can tell that there's more activity. And that all laid the groundwork for this becoming the regional Greco-Roman pagan capital of that area. Because once, after another transition, once it becomes Roman territory, Josephus tells us about Herod building a temple in Augustaeum in honor of the new Caesar on the hill. And it's after this that sets the groundwork for expanding this into an actual city. And the Temenos, or the temple area, the sanctuary area against the red cliffs that make up one side of the town, becomes a very active region. You not only have the cave there, but there are shrines to nymphs eventually made. You've got the Augustaeum. There is a temple to Zeus that's eventually built there. There are additional small shrines to Pan that are built. There's a shrine to Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine, that's also built. And so it really becomes the pagan capital of that region by the time you get to the New Testament era. Hmm. And that's when it was called Caesarea Philippi. But even when the name Caesarea Philippi was jettisoned, when it went back to Caesarea Paneas or Paneas, up until the middle, sort of crawling into the late 4th century, this still remained a very important pagan center for that part of the Levant.
Hmm. And it's clear that this was an important region for a long, long time, because going back to ancient history, of course, we know that that is where, according to the Book of Enoch, the Watchers descended and swore an oath to proceed with a plan that they had developed to take wives from among the daughters of men. And this is where I'm going to circle back to something I referenced earlier regarding the link between Mount Hermon and Jack the Ripper. Because in 1869, the archaeologist, he was actually an engineer working for the British military, but he was deployed to the Levant by the Crown under the auspices of the Palestine Exploration Fund, Sir Charles Warren.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Sir Charles Warren, who discovered Warren's shaft, through which David's general, climbed up into the city of Jerusalem and opened the door so that the Jebusites were defeated by David and his men. But the month before he found that, in September of 1869, he climbed to the summit of Mount Hermon and found on the summit of the mountain a temple, an ancient temple, still standing, although in some disrepair. It's called Kasr Antar. And this temple appears to date back to the Roman period, perhaps, maybe earlier. It had been known for a while. I mean, the people who lived in the region certainly knew the temple was there, but Westerners were familiar with it too. There was a Presbyterian minister named Josias Porter, I think, who in 1859 visited the site, wrote a travelogue of his time in Syria, and mentioned that he had visited the temple. But what he didn't see, and what Sir Charles Warren found, was a stela inside the temple. And this stela was very large. It was 12 inches, or about 18 inches wide, 4 feet high, and 12 inches deep, carved out of limestone. And in the limestone was carved in archaic Greek. Well, archaic. If it was in Greek, it couldn't have been before the time of Alexander, I presume. So 4th century BC or thereabouts. But in this Greek, on this stela, which weighed like 3 tons, was inscribed in Greek by the command of the greatest and holy God, those who swear an oath proceed from here. Now, yeah, Sir Charles came down the mountain, got permission from the Islamic ruler, the Ottoman ruler in a governor in Damascus, I think the Pasha was his title, to take the stone from Kasr Antar. I mean, it wasn't Islamic, so they didn't care. It's like, oh, yeah, nope. Maybe they received some remuneration, who knows? So Sir Charles cut this stone down from 18 inches or 10, 12 inches deep to 4 inches deep, which lightened it to about 2,000 pounds, and brought some donkeys and sleds up the mountain. And it still broke on the way down, but they managed to get it down the mountain and sent it back to London, where it was delivered in a crate to the British Museum. Now, somehow it was misplaced, and it wasn't actually opened and translated until about 1903 by the great French Orientalist, whose name is going to escape me at the moment, Clermont Ganneau, I think.
Okay.
Anyway, it was like 1900 or 1903, and you can still find the reports from the Palestine Exploration Fund online. But he translated it and said, "Oh, this must refer to the Watchers, the Watchers from the Book of Enoch. And more recently, George W.E. Nicholsberg, who's written a commentary on the Book of Enoch that I'm going to have to splurge and buy.
He's an amazing scholar. He's fantastic.
Well, I've got his translation, his Hermeneia translation of the Book of Enoch. And I think we're going to have to get the commentary, because in the commentary, he refers to this stela and confirms, yeah, this is what they were talking about. This referred to the incident with the Watchers. The question is, who were the Greeks in the pre-Christian era referring to as the greatest and holy God? And Nicholsberg thinks that it was Baal Hermon. Or Hermon. Yeah.
Quite possibly. Now, are you saying that they've dated this site to the Hellenic period?
Based on the temple and based on the Greek, yeah, they believe it was 3rd or 4th century BC. But here's as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story.
The rest.
This crate with this stela was returned by Sir Charles Warren to London in 1870. Well, 1888, Sir Charles Warren finds himself as the superintendent, the commissioner of Metropolitan Police. That's Scotland Yard in London. When Jack the Ripper begins using knives to carve up women in the East End, which is why I think it's so significant. You reminded us that Azazel, this goat demon, whose shrine is at the base of the mountain, is the one who taught humanity metalworking and the art of making edged weapons in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have to pass that on to Sharon, because even though she's opened book two of her Red Wing Saga series with the uncrating of this stela, I don't think she's made that connection. She may be aware of it. She's smarter than me, so she probably already knows this. So very often in our house, I'll discover something and I'll go to her and say, "Sweetheart, honey, did you know this?" And yes, did you not listen to my presentation in Chicago 4 years ago? But I'll tell her anyway.
That'll win you some time in the doghouse.
Yeah, well, I'll risk the rebuke just in case. But anyway, yeah, that's the link. Now, on a spiritual level, is it really connected? Don't know. Sharon, as a fiction author, can certainly take it and run with it, and she has. It is an interesting series of data points to connect. And when you're looking at this temple, and here's the other thing that I found fascinating, because Sir Charles was a surveyor. He surveyed Gibraltar for the British military.
Uh-huh.
He did a site drawing of the summit of Mount Hermon and shows the temple and then shows the summit. And on the summit, apparently there was a depression on the very top of the mountain, like a big cup. Now, the Belgian scholar Edward Lipinski speculates that this was for libations, drink offerings. And he points out, and I was not aware of this until I read this paper, called The Abode of El, in which he identifies Mount Hermon as the holy mountain of the chief Canaanite god El. So not only do you have the Watchers there, you've got El living there, according to Canaanite religion, with his 70 sons, which is why when Jesus came down the mountain after the Transfiguration, he sent out the 70 disciples. He's reversing right. There was a ritual that was performed by the Amorites called the Yarid, which was a ritual in which they would circumambulate a spot and then pour out a drink offering. But when you transliterate from Semitic to English, the Y becomes a J. So what he's saying is that it wasn't in the days of Jared the patriarch. It was in the days of Yarid, this festival where they would pour out a drink offering on the summit of Mount Hermon, that the Watchers came down. And he points out, and here's an interesting connection. Unfortunately, I learned it after I wrote my book, it's not in the book. The confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, the city god of Tyre, which is where Jezebel's father was the king, during the 8th century BC, or 9th century, when Elijah and Ahab and Jezebel were doing their thing, was Melkart. Melkart was the city god of Tyre at that time. And of course, Melkart was just the Phoenician name of Hercules. So it was actually probably the priests of Hercules, prophets of Hercules, that Elijah put to death. But It's documented that one of the rituals performed in honor of Melkart was this Yarid festival, where they would circumambulate and then pour out the drink offering, which is why Elijah, not just to make the wood wet to make it harder for God to ignite the sacrifice, Elijah was mocking the rituals that they performed for their God. Go down the mountain, bring up water from the brook, and dump it out on the wood. So again, another example of God reversing the pagan rituals of the Amorites.
That's right.
To demonstrate his superiority and his kingship. And so let's get to the watchers.
A ritual likely has this tie going back to the watchers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reverence of the watchers.
Oh, and one other thing that Warren speculated. Sir Charles was a very interesting guy and a very intelligent man, no doubt, because in his report for the Palestine Exploration Fund, he said, you know, the Muslims have a belief that their sacred cube in Mecca, the Kaaba, contains five stones from five holy mountains, Mount Ararat, the Mount of Olives. Let's see, what was the other one? Mount Carmel, Jabal al-Nur, which was where Muhammad received his revelation. And the fifth was Mount Hermon. Now, in his site drawing, which is like an overhead aerial view of the summit of Mount Hermon, Sir Charles noted that extending from the temple toward the summit was a low stone wall that looked much, much older than the Roman era temple where he found the stela. And to get to the summit, unless you wanted to climb over the wall, you had to circumambulate the summit in a counterclockwise fashion to get to it. Just like the Muslims have to circumambulate the Kaaba in a counterclockwise fashion. So his speculation is this. Did this practice of circumambulating the Kaaba actually begin way back in history with the watchers on the summit of Mount Hermon? Yeah.
Well, in the counterclockwise direction, of course, being also very important to ritual magic and witchcraft of a number of different species, would also be an interesting connection. And in fact, this is another thing that I wrote about in the second edition of Interview with the Giant. There's a chapter called The Primal Witch, and I connect the origins of witchcraft back to the tutelage of the Watchers. There's so much.
Yeah.
In terms of what's happening today on the spiritual landscape, that's dark and foreboding and dangerous, that finds its roots back at this event, back in the antediluvian world.
Right. Which is why Mike Heiser's book Reversing Hermon is so significant, so important, and why I keep stumbling onto things that when I compare them to the rituals of the ancient Amorites and their predecessors, the Sumerians, it's clear that God is not doing these things just for fun. It's a reversal. It is a making a mockery out of these rituals that the ancient pagan nations performed on a routine basis for hundreds or thousands of years. And the thing that most of us don't think about today, and to bring this up to the modern era, because this, you know, I find history and archaeology fascinating. I know you do as well. But for people listening, wondering why is this going on now for 45 minutes and we've not talked about, you know, Halloween or any of this stuff that they normally talk about. The working theory, and it certainly was the belief of the early Christians and certainly the Jews of the Second Temple period, the origin of demons was in the children of those watchers who descended on Mount Hermon 6,000 years ago or whenever it happened, that when God sent the flood and swept the planet clean except for the eight on the ark. The spirits of the Nephilim, according to the Book of Enoch, were, because they were miscegenated, they were an unholy union of divine and human, they were condemned to walk the earth and cause trouble for humanity until the end of time, until the judgment. The Greeks understood this. Hesiod pointed out that there was the spirits, as I mentioned earlier, the spirits of the men of the Golden Age, the heroes, the demigods, who became daimons and were kindly and helped mankind. And they were, you know, wanted nothing but good for us. So the Greeks knew the source. They just were telling the story from a different worldview. So in that sense, if demons really are the spirits of giants, the Nephilim, and that's who Jesus was casting out of the people that he freed from demonic oppression and possession in the first century, and they are the demons who still afflict humanity today, that we are still dealing with the consequences of that sin on Mount Hermon from thousands of years ago. We are still dealing with the giants today.
Indeed.
Your interview with Dr. Michael Bennett. Your interview with Dr. Michael Bennett on this whole thing and the significance of Peneus and Mount Hermon years ago on Future Quake, for me, was eye-opening. That sort of changed the whole trajectory of what I was researching when it came to the spirit realm. And now I'm like seeing that this is so key to understanding why Jesus did what he did and why God did what he did throughout history.
Well, I think I prefaced the first question he asked me, I prefaced with, you know, Jesus didn't do anything accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as you're finding out, as, you know, Mike Kaiser is finding out, as I'm finding out, as we continually delve into stuff, there's so much purpose and meaning behind every action that God took and takes against these entities. You know, on the surface, it may seem like something arcane and not really, you know, not much life application there, but there's purpose and meaning and deep meaning behind everything that God is doing. You know, there's no accident in here. There is deliberation and purpose behind all of this. And getting back to the issue of the demons being the disembodied spirits of the giants that were killed, you know, the Nephilim that were killed during the flood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is I find that it's a very uncomfortable, you know, even for people who are willing to talk about demons, you know, within the context of you know, let's say Bible studies or Sunday school or whatever, that it's a difficult concept. It's an uncomfortable sort of thing to think about because, for the longest time, I believed that demons were fallen angels.
Yeah,
but there's a taxonomy here, and if we just, like I've always said, if we just let the words say what they say, then we'll get to the true nature and the root of something like the concept of a demon. You know, if we go back to Enoch, even the language that's used there, the kind of phraseology that's used, you know, with you know, unclean spirits. Well, this pneumaponera, this is one of the most frequent used terms for demon in the New Testament. And that unclean state goes back to their very nature, that they're this, you know, this mixing of the divine with the mundane. And you have these aberrations, the giants and the chimerical creatures of the antediluvian world, the corrupted flesh that's not only referenced in canon, but also non-canon literature that was important to, you know, the Second Temple period and certainly the early church. These guys are referencing this stuff left and right. There does seem to be well, it's more than implied that they understood that there was a difference between the fallen angels and the demons. They were a very different kind of entity than what the fallen angels had been.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, if we don't equate the non-canon literature with scripture, but if you have authors that are referencing this material and they're writing under the inspiration of God, then it behooves us to take a look at what they're referencing, because obviously God inspired them to go looking and reference, you know, what we call non-canon literature today, you know, the apocryphal literature. And within those, we find, you know, particularly the Dead Sea Scroll material, we find, you know, just a plethora of material that shines light on the nature, the history, the entities, the corruption, and the nature and origin of demons that we're discussing here today. It all goes back to the series of events that occurred during the antediluvian world, and Enoch's pronouncement of judgment. People can look this up. You know, this stuff is public domain. Is very clear about, you know, their destiny is very clear, that they're meant to hamper and plague and oppress humanity. Always seeking sustenance and never being sated.
Mm-hmm.
So they're despicable, degenerate, unhappy creatures, obviously, in cases of demonic possession and demonic oppression. I think that that's very evident, especially in some of the more violent cases.
Yeah.
And it also explains why these people have superhuman strength and why they can speak in languages that they've never been exposed to. It's because you're dealing with supernatural intelligence that's been around for millennia.
Yeah, these are not these are not cute little costumes for our kids to put on at Halloween and not just things for us to take lightly. The movie The Exorcist, when it came out in the 70s, there was a line by Father Karras, who is the one who assists Father Marin in the exorcism of the girl. And tells the mother that the church stopped believing, and by the church he means the Roman Catholic Church, stopped believing in exorcism when they discovered the science of psychology. And as a Jesuit-trained psychiatrist, that was kind of his area of expertise. Interestingly, now we are in the 21st century, and the Roman Catholics appear to be the only ones taking this seriously, as they are recruiting priests and trying to educate and train a new generation of exorcists. Unfortunately, what they're training them to do is read Latin poetry at these demons, more or less, which our friend Russ Dizdar says, you know, as a deliverance minister, his experience is they don't care if you read poetry to them. It is through the power of Jesus Christ that they can be driven out. And I guess that's the good news. As we're looking at some frightening things, and there's some breaking news, and I know this podcast is not really set up for breaking news, but as we're recording this, Judd, on just to timestamp this for listeners, if you're listening to this later, Sunday, November 5th, and this is about 4:30 in the afternoon Central Time, news has been breaking this afternoon of a mass shooting at a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, First Baptist Church there. That's about 35 miles east of San Antonio. And it's a rural church, and apparently at least 25 people have been killed, 10 wounded. This would make it the deadliest church shooting in American history. The shooter apparently killed, no information yet that I've seen as I just scanned quickly trying to pay attention to our conversation. So I don't know anything about the shooter yet, except that he is no longer among the living. He now knows the truth of his relationship in the divine order, or his place in the divine order. I don't know how you characterize an event like this, or the event from last Tuesday with the Uzbek Saipov running down and killing eight people on a bike path in Manhattan, or Paddock shooting and killing dozens in Las Vegas, or the actions of the Islamic State over the last 3 years. I don't know any way to describe these inhuman and inhumane actions other than to call them demonic, which again places responsibility back on the Watchers and their hellish progeny from Mount Hermon.
That's right. That's right. Well, all of this is, whether the responsibility lies with individuals or with the Islamic State.
And to interject, just to interject, I want to make clear, I'm not blaming this on them, because clearly without human accomplices, they could do nothing. So clearly they've got willing human right. accomplices. So this does not absolve the humans involved for what they've done. I just want to be clear that I'm not placing blame entirely there, but certainly they are there to inspire people to act on these inhuman desires.
Certainly. Yeah, absolutely. Nor am I. I'm just not a, the devil made me do it sort of thing. We're not saying that that human agency, is not at fault.
We have free will
as well. But, in these days, we're in the West, we're supposedly embroiled in a war on terror. In my mind, one of the sources of this terror, again, goes back to the antediluvian world. If we're connecting these identities between these ancient gods, Pan being one and Azazel, in my mind, being the same, and other researchers also being the same, it shouldn't surprise us if we're believers and we're truly seeking discernment, the roots of these sorts of tragic events and larger agendas are rooted in the demonic. They're rooted in the misdeeds of the Watchers.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, this is something I've never really articulated on a show before, but it just seems, the terror aspect that seems to be spreading throughout the globe has Azazel's name written all over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, that's the root, his name of the name of the god Pan is where we get the word panic and pandemonium. And again, that's one of the aspects of his character recorded in ancient myths, his ability to inspire fear in opponents. In the interest of keeping this program to a manageable length, I know we've gone kind of far afield and we could spend several hours more talking about this, brother, but to keep this to a manageable length for listeners, I want to just to say, I think we've reached a good spot to stop, and because we've brought it into the modern age, and that's kind of what I wanted to do here. I mean, this is not a Halloween show per se, but the point was to bring to you a program showing that archaeologically, historically, there is reason to believe, especially if you are a Christian and you believe the basic premise of our faith, which is that we don't wrestle against power, the human opponents, but against principalities, powers, rulers of this present darkness, spiritual wickedness in high places, Ephesians 6:12. Then we have to look to the spirit realm for their influence and look at their influence on the modern world. And the headlines, if you can't get evidence from their action out of today's headlines, especially with what's going on in San Antonio or in South Texas right now, then you're just not paying attention. Dr. Jed Burton is the author of the book, Panaeus, Religion in the Ancient City of Pan. He's also the author of another book we recommend highly, which is Interview with the Giant, Ethnohistorical Notes on the Nephilim. For more of his work, you'll find it at his website, burtonbeyond.com. He's also founder and director of the Institute of Biblical Anthropology. If you want to pursue more academic queries along these lines, you'll find that website at tioba.org, tioba.org. Yeah, Jed, I know we've only scratched the surface here because there's a lot deeper we can go, but we brought the conversation around where I hoped it would go, and I appreciate your work and your willingness to share it with us over the years.
Well, Derek, I appreciate your work as well. Absolutely. It's my honor and my privilege.
Now, we'll have to do this again more often. Now, hopefully, I get back to a more regular schedule of recording these programs. Hang on the line. I'm going to close out the program here, but don't hang up so we can say goodbye before we go. Just want to remind you to keep up with our weekly Bible study. We are into the minor prophets now. Well, Jeremiah, not exactly a minor prophet. We just started on Jeremiah, but Zephaniah today on the Gilbert House Fellowship, episode number 175. So we got all 175 of those studies available for you to download at our site, gilberthouse.org, going all the way back to Genesis 1:1. And again, in Zephaniah today, we encountered some stuff that relates to what we were just talking about with Dr. Jed Burton here, Canaanite ritual and how God is going to turn that on its head in on the day of the Lord, which is the prophesied day when he pours out his wrath on an unbelieving world. Again, you'll find that at gilberthouse.org, and we update that usually by midday on Sundays. I guess that's it. I don't want to take too much here, especially given the tone on which we ended. Please, if you get a moment, give us a review at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find the podcast, which is available wherever fine podcasts are sold. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. The opening announcement, DC Good. Please remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.